Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, broadcasting from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Britta Moberg. Today we start off with coverage of a news conference from Monday on a proposed incinerator ash dump in Catskill.
Then we'll have our food diary featuring Ali Chafin, the director of service learning at the Sage Colleges.
After the interview, we talk with Rosanna Cotto-Batres of the Northeast New York Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health about their upcoming exhibit of 50 years of photojournalist Earl Dotter covering the faces of labor across the U.S.
And we're going to end up with Dave Pueblo, who is one of the, I believe, 50 people arrested today down at the Extinction Rebellion event in New York City on climate change. For a while, I know they shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. But and that was also in conjunction with all the protests taking place in London this week. But first, let's start off with some headlines. The city of Troy is seeking a developer that will have the financial resources to build as many as three commercial buildings at One Monument Square while adhering to four design elements city residents want at the 1.2-acre site, according to documents issued by the city. This is the city's fifth attempt to develop the site where City Hall stood until it was raised in 2011 to clear the way for new construction that would anchor downtown redevelopment.
The Times Union reports that the Sexual Harassment Working Group, made up of eight former state legislative staffers, are pressing the legislature to hold at least two more public hearings on workplace sexual misconduct. Even though the February 13th hearing was 11 hours, many workers, government agencies, and others did not have a chance to testify and provide crucial input to craft legislation, the group said in a statement.
The Times Union reports that a judge is expected to delay the trial of James White, who is accused of killing two women and two children in Landsberg, in order to allow him time to review hours of videos prosecutors plan to use as evidence. White said he had not been given access to a laptop computer at the Rensselaer County Jail to watch the videos, which come from CDTA buses and cameras from around the Landsberg home where White and another man allegedly carried out the killings on December 21, 2017. White's former co-defendant, Justin Mann, pleaded guilty August 5th to four counts of second-degree murder.
The latest census data for New York agriculture shows a 6% drop in the number of farms statewide. The state has 33,438 farms in the state, about 2,100 fewer farms than 2012. This is the largest drop in more than two decades and is triple the national average of a 30% loss. New York saw a nearly 20% decline in the number of dairy farms in the state. The average net farm income of $42,875 per farm is slightly below the national average.
In an attempt to share the city's energy saving and sustainability efforts, the city of Saratoga has added a new section on the city's website that will help residents track the city's progress on everything from energy savings generated by the solar park to energy uses at every city property. The Sustainability Hub also directs residents to where they can find a shareable bike, charge an electric vehicle, and find a trail to hike.
Vermont's largest utility company, Green Mountain Power, announced it has set a goal to use 100% carbon-free energy by 2025 and 100% renewable energy by 2030. It announced this in December 2018 that its energy supply was already 90% carbon-free and 60% renewable.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at mediasanctuary.org. Wheel Abrader Technologies, the second largest trash incinerator company in the U.S., wants to create an ash dump in the town of Catskill near the Hudson River. Paul Galley of Riverkeeper and former Region 2 EPA Administrator Judith Enck spoke at a news conference on April 15th opposing the project.
Paul Galley, I'm the president of Riverkeeper, which is an organization created about 55 years ago to protect the character of the Hudson Valley, our water reserves, and assure that we were creating more sustainable communities, not repeating old mistakes that had led to some pretty bad decisions and pretty serious pollution problems. We're looking at a proposal today that the Wheelabrator Incinerator Company has brought to the town of Catskill to create an enormous toxic incinerator ash dump in the old Peckham Quarry that would go on for 48 years of operation, 48 years of toxic dust, toxic leachate, and toxic ash coming into one of our most valued, pristine, and important communities. And Riverkeeper is part of an amazing coalition of groups who are here and represented, and who are represented in a letter that we've sent to the supervisor of Catskill this morning in order to say, we did not just spend the last 50 years cleaning up the Hudson River and strengthening community character in its shoreline towns just to start importing toxic incinerator ash into those communities. We need a better way for this site. We have a growing coalition, as I mentioned earlier. I think there are 180 signatories on the letter that we've sent to Supervisor in Catskill. And we have 53 organizations who are signed on to it as well, that this is not a proposal that should move forward, that we should be concentrating as soon as possible on assuring that there's a better answer for this site. Now, a quick word about the State Department of Environmental Conservation. And we want to make sure that Supervisor Davis is well aware that the DEC has sent two letters to the Wheelabrator Company about this project already, and they are both extremely critical of the suitability of this site for the intended use. And as a consequence, we think that it's important that the supervisor realize we could take years in a process that will almost certainly, if the right result is reached, lead to the denial of the application, or we can get more quickly to the end to this bad proposal and the beginning for deliberations and discussions within the community and with the site owner about what would be a better solution for the site. So I'm going to introduce Judith Enck at this point. And Judith Enck is a senior fellow and visiting faculty member at Bennington College, where she teaches classes on plastic pollution and is the founder of Beyond Plastics. Appointed by President Obama, she served as the regional administrator of the U.S. EPA overseeing environmental protection in New York, New Jersey, 8 Indian nations, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Judith previously served as Deputy Secretary for the Environment in New York Governor's office.
I too have spent about the last 30 years working to clean up the Hudson, and I grew up in Greene County, went to high school in Catskill. The Wheelabrator Incinerator Company wants to build this new ash landfill less than a half mile from the Hudson River. They want to bring in about 445,000 tons of ash every year to Catskill. They want this ash dump near the Hudson River to last for 48 years. Their current plan is to bring toxic incinerator ash from their existing facilities in Peekskill in Westchester County, Poughkeepsie, and also in Hudson Falls. And they also leave the opportunity open to bring in ash from other incinerators, likely in the Northeast. We are very concerned about the public health and the environmental impacts of this project, and today are calling on Catskill Town Supervisor Doreen Davis to reject this proposal. Wheelabrator is the second largest incinerator company in the country. They own 19 garbage incinerators and 3 ash dumps. They are a waste-burning giant, and they are about to get bigger. On February 12th of this year, Wheelabrator announced that they have been bought out by Macquarie Infrastructure Partners, which is part of the Macquarie Group, a large multinational bank. Wheelabrator wants to establish this new ash dump in Catskill on Route 9W in an old quarry mine recently purchased a few years ago by Peckham Industries. The whole operation will cover about 159 acres. Garbage incineration does not eliminate the need for landfills. For every 4 tons of solid waste that's burned, you get 1 ton of ash. Incinerators generate 2 different kinds of ash: fly ash, which is the fine particles that collect on the air pollution control equipment of incinerators and coal plants and anything with a big smokestack. And then bottom ash, which is the non-combustible residue. Think about what you see at the bottom of a wood stove or the bottom of a fireplace. It's of that quality. It's very fine. Fly ash in particular has a high concentration of toxic compounds. Fly ash has dioxins, the most toxic material known to science. It's a byproduct of combustion. When you burn solid waste, in particular plastics, you generate dioxin. Incinerator ash has a range of heavy metals, including lead, a neurotoxin, which affects children's ability to learn, mercury, which damages our central nervous system, kidneys, and developing fetuses. Incinerator ash also has cadmium, arsenic, and chromium, to name just a few of the heavy metals. Over the years, the ash has gotten more toxic because incinerators are burning more plastic and then more electronic waste in batteries, which are loaded with heavy metals. It's amazing that Wheelabrator wants to run an ash dump so close to the Hudson for 48 years. This will last at least 48 years. For people in Catskill, today might be the first time they're hearing about this proposal. Wheelabrator has had many meetings with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. They submitted their initial permit application to the DEC 2 years ago. And this project has been known to the town of Catskill, but we don't know for how long. In its permit application to the DEC, Wheelabrator says the following: initial engagement with the public sector demonstrated community interest in having the project move forward through the due process review. We'd like to know who in the public sector said that to Wheelabrator to start this multi-year process. Now, I want to preview something for you. When you call Wheelabrator, they're going to say, oh, our ash is not toxic. It's not regulated as toxic. And what happened is in the mid-80s, incinerator ash was failing the toxicity test that environmental regulators used. Fly ash failed 100% of the time, bottom ash failed 39% of the time, and the combined ash samples failed 48% of the time. If this ash was considered a hazardous waste, every incinerator in this country would be shut down because it would be expensive to send the ash to permitted commercial hazardous waste facilities, and there's just not enough space. Wheelabrator argued in court that if general solid waste was exempt from toxic testing, ash should also be exempt. This went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which in 1994 ruled that incinerator ash must be tested, and if it failed, it must go to a hazardous waste facility. At that time, the state of New York argued that the ash should not be ruled toxic, but should be considered a, quote, special waste, and to go to a special waste landfill. An old quarry mine is not a special waste landfill. The court then left it to the EPA to determine how the toxic leachate test was done, and EPA changed the testing protocol, making it much more lax. So Wheelabrator will argue it's not regulated as a toxic material, but in fact, if you take samples, you will see that it's toxic. And what really matters is that this toxicity will reach groundwater and the Hudson, no matter what you call it. One noted scientist called this linguistic detoxification. A few words about Wheelabrator. In 2011, the state of Massachusetts fined Wheelabrator a record $7.5 million for violating environmental laws at their incinerator and ash landfill sites. multiple violations of the Hazardous Waste Management Act and the Clean Water Act. The Massachusetts Environmental Commissioner at the time called it the highest ever for a state case arising out of environmental violations. So they, Wheelabrator holds the record at the time for the highest environmental fine in the state of Massachusetts. Some of the Wheelabrator violations are very relevant to what they are attempting to do in Catskill. State investigators found a hole in the roof and the side wall of the Wheelabrator ash house, enabling the ash to be released into the atmosphere. They failed to properly treat the ash before disposal and release of wastewater into surrounding wetlands. At another Wheelabrator facility, they released 15,000 gallons of ash water. Untreated ash was transported from the plant to landfills in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And what I think it's important is that the Massachusetts Environmental Strike Force started their investigation in 2009, but did not include it and conclude it until 2011. So you've got a two-year period where damage is occurring. And if you want a more recent example of how Wheelabrator is not a good neighbor, Wheelabrator recently sued the city of Baltimore for not sending enough waste from their city to be burned in the Wheelabrator incinerator in Baltimore. They are penalizing the people of Baltimore for recycling and composting and reducing their waste stream and not sending them enough waste. Wheelabrator is suing the city of Baltimore for $32 million because Baltimore is doing a good job at recycling. What Wheelabrator does is they target communities that are economically struggling. They count on people not having the time to stand up against them. I know that the people of Catskill and the neighboring communities are going to focus on this. And there are some important local questions that need to come up, particularly involving the leachate from the ash dump. So today, we are all calling on Catskill Town Supervisor Doreen Davis to stand up for her community and to reject this proposal. She has said that she wants to wait a few years for the state to complete its review. That is a mistake. After an important article appeared in the Catskill Daily Mail in February, the town of Catskill put a notice on its website saying, quote, "We have been assured that this project does not involve any burning, does not involve any organic materials, and does not create any gas emissions." Does not say who they've been assured by. It goes on to say that if this is approved for our industrial corridor, the local community will receive additional revenue. So this is not exactly a neutral statement. We don't know how much money Wheelabrator is offering the town of Catskill. In my view, no amount of money paid to the town of Catskill by Wheelabrator is justified such a risky project, no matter how much money they are offering. When the public and health and environmental threats of this magnitude are in play, we need local elected officials to stand up for their community. Local elected officials cannot outsource their responsibility. I am confident that the DEC will take a very close look at this because the project is so risky. But Wheelabrator will have their own lawyers, their own engineers at the table, and concerned citizens simply won't have the tens of thousands of dollars that are needed to keep up and fully participate in this process. People in Catskill are not going to make donations totaling $100,000 or so to fight this project. And this is the same phenomena that we see happening in the city of Rensselaer, for instance, with a very polluting construction and demolition debris landfill. So Catskill needs to stand up for itself, and all of the elected officials need to tell Wheelabrator they are not welcomed in Catskill with this project.
That was Paul Gallet of Riverkeeper, and just finished up with former Region 2 EPA Administrator Judith Ank, who happens to be my wife, a community meeting on the proposed incinerator ash dump will take place on April 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Catskill Community Center, 344 Main Street.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. HMM correspondent and Unity House Food Security Manager interviews Allie Schaefing, Director of Service Learning at the Sage Colleges, about her work.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, here with another Food Diary. And today my guest is Allie from the Sage Colleges.
Yes, hello everyone. My name is Allie Schaefing. I am the Director of Service Learning at the Sage Colleges.
And I'm so excited for you to share the stories of some of the work that you've been doing with food in the area.
Great. Yeah, I'd love to share. We have three classes in the past couple semesters that really focus on food. So if time allows, I'll go through all three of them. The first is through a class called Food, Culture, and Nutrition. It is a general education class in our humanities program taught by nutrition faculty. And the class has been operating for years and years with an awesome textbook and an awesome syllabus. But about a year ago, I approached the faculty and asked if we could integrate some service into the curriculum, because that's my charge at the colleges. I try to help faculty integrate community engagement into their teaching. And a class like Food, Culture, and Nutrition is really, really well suited for that. So we got together and we workshopped the syllabus and reached out to partners, and we're really proud of the work we've been doing. So the basic idea here is that the students in the class, the college students, go volunteer at various refugee and immigrant organizations and get to know those folks a bit over the course of a few weeks. And at the end of those few weeks, the students interview a refugee or an immigrant one-on-one on their particular food culture. And they have extensive conversations about what they like to eat, what they miss from their home country, what kinds of things they're not able to find here in the grocery stores or in the gardens that they wish they could. Are there particular spices that they don't have access to? Are things affordable? How do they get to the grocery store? All kinds of aspects of food access, affordability, and accessibility. And the college students then write up a report. And this past year, we compiled all of those reports across the Capital District. We had about 75 of them, 75 one-on-one conversations. Compiled all that and shared it with Capital Roots, the wonderful nonprofit that does so much cool work around food in the Capital District. And in that way, we're contributing to the Capital Roots Food Assessment Map project, where they're really trying to understand how accessible and affordable food is. And one component of that is cultural appropriateness of food. So we tried to really help in that particular component of the project.
That's so great. I love knowing all the webs that you're weaving. And just to explain it a little further for people who might not be familiar with this movement of service learning. Service learning is about creating a bridge between campuses and communities. Anything you want to elaborate on?
Yes, I'd love to. Yes, you're exactly right. It's a bridge between campus and communities. The relationship between the community and the campus needs to be mutually beneficial. It's really important that the community organization and community leaders are dictating the early stages of these partnerships. So that means I go around and I meet with the various nonprofits or activists or whoever it is that we might be working with, and really try to get a sense of how we could serve them in ways that support their work without undermining or bringing in our ideas about how things should be done. You know, it's not about a college going out and making changes for the community. It's about working together with shared values and shared goals.
So, and sharing that intellectual curiosity and research potential.
Yes.
Which I really love. Yeah. I know in my work at Unity House, you came in and we had one of those conversations, and your students have been coming in. You want to talk about the class that they're situated in?
Yes, I would love to. So that class is part of the nutrition program as well. That class is called Community Nutrition. And all of these classes are really well aligned for service learning, though I have to be honest, I argue that all classes are really aligned for service learning, because I think it's a really important component of higher education to prepare students to be a part of real service in the community, real engagement with the real world, so to speak. So in that particular class, the students in Community Nutrition are choosing a healthy dish to prepare themselves. So they're this past semester trying to focus especially on, and Amy, you and I talked about this, foods that are available in abundance at food pantries. So some foods that maybe don't move off the shelves as quickly, but that these nutrition students believe to be healthy. So lentils and dry beans and whole wheat pastas. So then the students prepare a dish and make a poster with nutrition facts and fun facts, and they try to make it a really aesthetically pleasing and, you know, low literacy, just something that everyone can access. And then they go to the food pantries, hopefully during a busy time, and give out samples of their tasty treat. And we encourage them to be friendly and open and try to get to know some folks coming in and out and have nice little chats about what they like to eat, how they might integrate some of the food pantry items that are maybe a little healthier than others, and, you know, provide this kind of mutually beneficial interaction, but also deliver, you know, really basic nutrition information.
It's an incredible resource because food pantries and soup kitchens like mine at Unity House, we are meeting people where they're at a lot of times a month. 750 families rely on Unity House a month.
Wow.
For that's just in the food pantry. So for you partners to come into our skeletal staffing and skeletal volunteering system and really do this outreach and education, it really amplifies our efforts in a way that I really hope you understand. It's key to I can feel the success.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. And it's great to take a minute to, you know, at the end of every semester, I try to reflect with the community partners and the faculty and the students. And that's a big part of service learning is preparation and reflection. You know, it's not just showing up at the pantry and doing some hours. And that's helpful, too. But it's really trying to understand the structural issues involved and the complications and, you know, prepare for that setting, do the work, and then come back and, you know, reflect on it. Make sure everyone involved is understanding what's going on and how we can do better. And so it's really great to hear your perspective on that. Ultimately, our main goal is to serve the community. And they're great. I mean, every class we do has these great little anecdotes. I'm thinking of one particular day at the YWCA pantry where an older gentleman said no thank you to the whole wheat pasta sample. He said it several times. And then the one student, one of my college students, kind of kept charming him and making jokes and this and that. Finally, he says, all right, give me a bite of that. And he took a bite and he said to the gal behind the pantry counter who was compiling his bag, all right, give me some of that whole wheat, you know, S-H-I-T. And, you know, went away that day talking about fiber and protein. And, you know, I heard that student then tell her professor in the classroom. And that's the kind of thing that a college student is going to remember from their experience. So,
that's so great. It's so great because the education we get on a campus is not going to live with us the rest of our lives on a campus. Right. It's going to live with us out in our work worlds.
That's exactly right.
So I love these intersections and I'm really looking forward because on Thursday night, you and I have a chance to have another dialogue about this at Unity House. Our monthly meal called Talk Soup is happening on Thursday, April 18th, 5:30 p.m., 2431 6th Avenue. Everyone is welcome. And then Allie and I will be having a longer conversation about how we can change the food world with our little levers. So please, I hope people will join us. And if people, if other community organizations want to know about Sage's work, how can they find you?
Great. Thank you for asking. I can always be reached via email at Sage, which is SCHAEA@sage.edu. You can also forget that and just Google the Sage College's Director of Service Learning, and you should get to my page where we've got some cool spotlights and all kinds of contact information. And we always love to develop new partnerships and strengthen existing partnerships. And as I mentioned earlier, I argue that every single class, every single discipline can integrate service, and it's something we feel really strongly about. So we welcome new conversations all the time.
And we can also encourage the rest of the institutions in the area to think about more service learning. And
Yes. Actually, Amy, I'm really glad you mentioned that. Simultaneously, while we are all, you know, local colleges doing work on our own campuses, we just got a grant from the American Association of Colleges and Universities to form a regional council on community engagement. So we're really excited. We've got about 8 to 10 local campuses signed on to be a part of this, and we want everyone involved. So if you have any interest, whether you're a community folk or a campus folk and want to sit down and have one of these conversations, please get in touch, because we want to work together and strengthen everybody's work.
That's great. Thank you so much, Allie. This
Thank
has been
you.
Another Food Diary with Amy Halloran, Unity House Food Security Manager.
And that was another Amy segment featuring Allie Chafin, the Director of Service Learning at the Sage Colleges.
For those just tuning in, I'm Britta.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Central Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments or suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Rosanna Cotto-Batres is the Education and Training Coordinator at the Northeast New York Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health, or NINICOSH. She works with low-wage immigrant and refugee workers to empower and educate them on workspace health and safety issues. NINICOSH is bringing photojournalist Earl Dodder's life's work, a 50-year photographic chronicle of working in the USA, exhibit to the Capital Region next week, April 22nd to 26th, where it'll be shown at the beautiful Legislative Office Building in commemoration of Workers' Memorial Week. So welcome, Rosanna. Can you maybe give us a brief introduction to what NINICOSH is and what you do?
Yes, thank you for having me here. So NINICOSH is a local nonprofit. We were founded in 2014, and we do a lot of work around occupational health and safety. So what that entails is we have like three branches of the work that we do. One is training, because we feel that a lot of occupational fatalities, a lot of injuries that happen on the job could be prevented. And the way to prevent that is by educating people about their rights. So we do a lot of basic health and safety trainings. We partner with groups that are, connecting people to jobs, doing other job readiness classes, ESL classes for a lot of the refugee workers and immigrant workers that we have in the Capital District. And we teach them about what hazards they may face in their job, how to control for those hazards, what their rights are, and how to enforce those rights. And then, of course, what to do in the event that an injury happens to them. And then the other thing we do is we advocate for workers. So we, try to push for legislation that protect workers. We follow up on fatalities that happen in the region. And we try to make sure that occupational injuries and illnesses are something that people are thinking about and working to prevent. And then the other thing that we do is that we provide technical assistance to other organizations that maybe are small and don't have an occupational safety and health program. If they have any questions around occupational safety and health, our board and our organization is connected to a lot of experts in the field that could help them with any questions they have.
So I was actually a little bit surprised to find out that your group primarily does not work with union members. Apparently, they probably get their own training. So maybe you just tell us a little about what are some of the workers you do, try to provide support to?
Yes, that's correct. So we, a lot of union members and unions tend to have their own health and safety committee. So we focus more on what we call vulnerable workers. So that's workers that, because of the nature of their occupation or, their language proficiency, their age, their immigration status, they may face more obstacles to receiving this information and being able to put it to action. So we do a lot of trainings for low-wage workers, people that are temporary work or contingent workers, in different industries that have one job one day and another job another day. Young workers tend to get injured at a high rate because they're inexperienced. And at the same time, people on the other end of the spectrum, older workers, also kind of become complacent, and we see a lot of injuries among those groups of workers. And then, of course, you know, in the Capital District, we have a lot of immigrants and refugees. So we focus a lot of our trainings on recently arrived immigrants, whether or not they have, you know, documentation status, and then also all the groups of refugees that we have here.
That's great and so important to provide those resources for the underrepresented groups. So what can you tell us a little bit more about Earl Dotter?
Yes, so we're excited to be bringing the work of Earl Dotter to the Capital District. He has been working in the field of occupational safety and health as a photojournalist for the last 50 years. So he started as a VISTA volunteer in the 70s, and he quickly got involved with working with coal mine workers, so documenting some of the illnesses that they were experiencing. And at the time, you know, unions had a photographer, so he became a photographer for one of the coal mine unions down in Appalachia. So he's been around for a long time, and he is, you know, really world-renowned as the photographer of workers, documenting where workers work, where they get injured. And we've, you know, some of his photographs that we'll see are not only from the 70s, but also all the way up to today. So he's still active today, and he's taking a lot of pictures of people, like I mentioned, coal mine workers, farm workers, people that work in healthcare. He was there when 9/11 happened and the first responders were there. So his work is really powerful, and it really shows the dignity of workers.
So this is part of the Workers' Memorial Week. So maybe you explain first a little bit more about what the Workers' Memorial, you know, Week is, and then how, you know, particularly some of the photographs or the exhibit, you know, amplifies that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so every week, every year around April 22nd to 28th, internationally, we celebrate Workers' Memorial Week. And that's a week to honor and remember workers who have died on the job. So in the U.S. every year, a little over 5,000 workers die. And that's from instant injuries that happen on the job. And then another...
If I could just step back on that, how does that compare to other, like, say, industrial nations? Any idea?
That's about the same as other industrial nations. I think, you know, we see a lot more injuries and fatalities happening in non-industrialized nations because there's less protections. Mm-hmm. But we still think that it's a number that's too high, right? And then every year there's also another 60,000 to 70,000 workers who died from occupational illnesses. So that's due to, you know, mm-hmm. cancers, you know, people being exposed to lead and asbestos and other chemicals. And so this week is a week to honor and remember all the workers who have died from occupational related, you know, injuries or illnesses, and also to do something about it, to take some action.
What can you tell us about the exhibit so that we can entice listeners to come out and check it out? Because it sounds great.
Yeah, so the photographs will be exhibited at the Legislative Office Building. And I feel like they really do tell a story when you walk around them. So we're going to have over 100 photographs, you know, from different time periods of Earl's career. And there are notes under each photograph telling you who the worker is, what the scene is like. So there really is a human story to the whole exhibit. And that's what we're trying to convey, that behind these statistics and all these numbers, there is a human side to it.
I'm going to take a little guess that, especially in the private sector, that some of these companies weren't particularly thrilled with the idea that somebody was going to come in and take photos of the workers, particularly since that might expose sometimes rather unsanitary, unsafe working conditions. Any idea how, you know, Earl sort of managed that over time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how he got into all the different workplaces, but I think his perspective is always, you know, just documenting workers in their job. And the hazards are not very obvious to people that may not work in this field. You know, you just see a farm worker picking berries, but we know that, you know, there's chemicals associated with that and that there's ergonomic hazards. So I think the way that Earl, through his photographs, is able to convey the story of what is happening behind it makes it, you know, non-threatening to an employer who may be willing to have their workers being photographed. And I will say that while Earl is here that whole week, he's going to be in the Capital District, we've also coordinated him to take pictures of workers in the Capital District. So we've partnered with some of the local unions, some of the nonprofit organizations that we work with in the city of Albany to photograph their workers. So I think, you know, it's an opportunity to show and appreciate the work that people do. And that's how he's able to get in.
Yeah, that sounds great. So how would you say that this photo exhibit relates to the core mission of NennyKosh and what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I would say it's at the core of what we're trying to do, because at the core of what we do is to educate people, right? Whether it's workers or the community at large. And this really is a great event to educate the public. We're so glad that we're able to have the exhibit at a great public open space, right? The Legislative Office Building. We're working with Assemblymember Fahey and New York State Senator Neil Breslin to bring this together. And so we are hopeful that a lot of people will take the opportunity to go. You know, it's spring break for many schools, so we're hoping that parents will be able to take their kids there, and people that work in the Empire State Plaza will just pop in to see it.
Where in the plaza or the LOB is this going to be located? Do you know that?
Yes. So it's in the Legislative Office Building on the concourse level, just before you get to security to go into the Empire State Plaza concourse level area. And it's right by the small cafeteria in the Legislative Office Building.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we've, you know, talked a bit about some of the workplace hazards that workers face. But I assume there's probably also photos that are perhaps just more, you know, inspirational in terms of some of the things that workers do that, you know, many people may not be aware of.
Yes, definitely. To a lot of these pictures, there are, you know, the appreciation of what workers do. So there's a lot of pictures of healthcare workers and taking care of patients. And you see, you know, that they're lovingly taking care of these patients that that they're serving. So there's definitely that aspect. And there's also pictures of people with their families. So not all the photographs are in a workplace. Some of them are just in people's homes, you know, with their families. But it's a compilation of all the workers in that industry, you know, being shown in the exhibit.
You know, so earlier we talked about some of the, you know, 5,000 deaths, workplace accidents a year, 60,000, you know, deaths from sort of chronic diseases. You know, are there reforms that NennyKosh has been, you know, trying to get the, I don't know, the legislature or the federal government to adopt to increase workplace safety for people?
Yes. So we actually are following closely the case of a young man who was killed on the job 3 years ago. His name is Justice Booz, and he was employed for just a day to work in a small landscaping company. He was given no training and no information on how to do his job. And he was operating a wood chipper when he was pulled into mm-hmm. it, and he died immediately. So on May 4th will be the third year anniversary of his death. And so we're following closely his case. We're in touch with his fiance. And we see that as just one example of the things that we can do. So we've been trying to work with some of the New York City KOSH groups and other groups in the state to get stronger penalties for employers who knowingly and willingly put their workers at risk of injuries or death. So that's something that we're working on. We're also working with Citizen Action and a coalition to pass a paid sick days law to make sure that workers who, you know, are sick are able to take time off from work, because what we see is many workers who are sick and are not able to take time off from work and then suffer, you know, come back to work and they suffer injuries and they get hurt because there's more incidents that happen because they're not feeling well. And also this is, you know, related to the opioid epidemic. So a lot of people in construction and other industries that are forced to work through pain end up having to take a lot of pain medication to just continue to get to work. So those are some of the things that we're working on.
So this exhibit by Earl Dodder's Life's Work, a 50-year photographic chronicles of working in the USA, is going to be at the LOB Legislative Office Building in Albany, April 22nd to 26th. If there are workers out there saying, boy, I could use some training or I could use some information about you know, my work situation, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so they can visit our website, www.nennykosh.org, or email us at nennykosh@gmail.com.
Well, Rosanna, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. And we're going to jump now to talk to Dave Pablo, who is our correspondent, actually down in New York City, and he has been covering the Extinction Rebellion. Now, you probably may have heard about the Extinction Rebellion the last 3 days. Has been blockading the bridges in London around climate change. Dave, what was the situation in New York City? Dave, can you hear me? Well, we're going to work on getting Dave back on the air in just a moment. I don't know if we have to put him on hold first. But Rosanna, why don't you hear? What haven't we asked you about? I mean, one of the things I was curious about is why Nennykosh just recently got organized here in the Capital District, because I know there have been many Koshes already around the state.
Yes. So the Kosh Network is a network of about 20 other organizations that are similar to ours throughout the country. And we're all kind of organized under the umbrella of National Kosh, the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. And, you know, there's groups throughout different states in the country. And in the Capital District, you know, there are a lot of very strong unions that really care about the safety and health of their workers. But there wasn't anyone really talking about the low-wage workers that are not usually in unions. And so we felt that it was important to found an organization like this.
Okay. Dave, have we found you yet? Okay. Where does your group get funding from?
So we receive funding from the Department of Labor, the New York State Department of Labor. They have a great training program called the Hazard Abatement Board Training Program. And that's money that a lot of other New York State groups receive. And we're also lucky to partner with some of the other Kosh groups that I mentioned. There are actually three in New York State, apart from ours. So there's one in Buffalo called the Western New York Kosh. There's one in Ithaca called the Mid-State Kosh. And one in New York City that's been around for many years called NYKOSH or New York City Kosh. So we get funding by partnering with them through the OSHA Susan Harwood Grant. And that's also a grant program that is targeted at reaching hard to reach populations of workers. So that's how we are able to do a lot of our work and a lot of our trainings.
And what got you interested in this position?
So I actually have my background is in social work, but I was always interested in, you know, researching and learning more about immigrant health. And I hadn't really heard about occupational health until I did an internship in New York City when I graduated with my master's in social work. And that's an occupational health internship program. So in that program, I really learned a lot about the connection of how immigrants in particular are impacted by health and safety issues. And that's a way to organize workers and really empower them to take charge of their own, not only their own health, but also their own lives. So in this movement, the occupational health and safety field is very closely aligned with the immigrant rights work. And so, you know, a lot of workers that are immigrants, they don't know their rights. They are always afraid. And so it's very important to, as we provide them this information, educate them about their rights, that they do have rights regardless of their documentation status. They have a right to a safe and healthy workplace. They can still call OSHA and report an inspection or report any hazards. And most importantly, if they do get injured on the job, they have the right to receive workers' comp, you know, workers' compensation. And that varies from state to state. But in New York, workers, regardless of their immigration status, documentation status, they can still receive these benefits. And so we think that that's important to convey to people, especially with everything that's happening politically and in the U.S., right, around the attack on immigrants.
Now, one group of workers that don't have many basic labor rights, particularly here in New York State, as farm workers. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we've been working on that issue about 20, 25 years. So do you get many farm workers coming in and asking for, you know, existing? Because you were working around farm machinery. That's a dangerous occupation.
Right, yeah. Unfortunately, because of the nature of where many of these farms are located, we're not in close reach to farm workers. But once in a while, through our partners, we do hear about instances of people needing more information or help. And we've actually worked with to provide trainings to some of the Saratoga racetrack workers. So that's another, similar in the fact that they're excluded from some of these protections, but also different because they're not technically considered farm workers because they're working with animals. So there's definitely a need for training and educating farm workers and continuing to work to make sure that they get the rights that they deserve, that every other worker in the U.S. gets.
Now, you mentioned, of course, that immigrants can be nervous about, for understandable reasons, about a certain, their right to, adequate safety measures. And I wonder, since, Trump has become president, whether you've seen less willingness, on the federal agencies to step in and try to protect, individuals, particularly in industries where there's a high percentage of, immigrant workers?
Yeah. I think in New York State, there's definitely a lot of great protections for workers, regardless of their documentation status. But I will say that there's, definitely an attack on immigrants throughout the whole country and in New York State as well. And we see that people are less willing to report instances of occupational hazards or injuries that happen on the job because they're worried that it's going to connect them to, ICE or put them in danger of being deported. There's just that much more fear around all of this.
Well, Rosanna, we want to thank you very much for jumping in and saving our necks a little bit. But I believe we got Dave on the phone.
Yep. Here I am.
Oh, great. Okay. So as we mentioned earlier, Dave has been down there in New York City trying to cover the Extinction Rebellion event. I saw some videos that they actually shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan side for a while. But why don't you tell us what was going on down there?
I wouldn't say that they shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan side. There are so many different lanes that exit and enter the bridge. But they did occupy one section of it for sure and bring traffic to a stop. You basically had about 50 people all together, maybe split up 50-50. Half of them were standing, blocking a crosswalk, essentially linked arm in arm, and then the rest of them were doing a die-in. I would have to say that the bulk of the people doing the die-in were from Troy and surrounding,
The
Capital
bulk
region
was
areas.
From Troy, New York?
That's correct. Troy was very well represented at this action.
Hmm. And yep. How does this relate to the Extinction Rebellion effort that's been taking place this week in London, where they've had 3 days of arrests so far, blocking mass transit?
Well, this is definitely the New York City version of it. Extinction Rebellion in the UK has reached out internationally and encouraged people in many countries to set up their own, basically, cells. And New York City has, I think, done 3 actions so far. The first one was at the Rockefeller Center. I don't know the details of the second one. And today's, of course, was right in front of City Hall, kind of in the face of the mayor, saying that the proposals by the city administration, city council, just didn't quite cut it in terms of really addressing climate change and giving us all a chance.
Now, I know that the group internationally now has been calling for 100% clean energy by 2025, which is a little bit faster than the Green New Deal, but certainly a whole lot faster than, say, the CCPA, which a lot of groups have been pushing. When you talk, I know you're going to have some recordings next week for us, but when you talk to people today, what were some of the issues or motivations that they expressed during the event, like why they were participating?
Well, they were all echoing certainly the platform that's been expressed by Extinction Rebellion in UK, but it had a much more personal touch to it as well. I interviewed at least two or three people that specifically named their children as their motivating factor. Of course, our own Melissa Bromley at the sanctuary took part in this action today, and she's 6 months pregnant. So it's a very personal thing. People aren't just looking at this as some cold policy issue, of course, because it really hits everybody on an existential level, and a lot of people are grieving over the process of watching mass extinctions of wildlife and threats to our own survival.
Now, New York City police are a little bit notorious for not being as, say, nice or as gentle or as professional as some of the police we see here at demonstrations, particularly in the city of Albany, but even at the state level. Have people been released so far? I mean, they were arrested, earlier this morning? How has that processing been going?
Yeah, those arrests were all, everybody was basically handcuffed and put on buses by noon. There's no sign that they are at any close point to being released as of yet, and it really wouldn't surprise me if they are kept overnight. I would think that would be standard New York City Police Department policy, actually, especially for an action like this, which was, basically right in front of City Hall, called out the mayor in various ways, and involved, 50 people obstructing traffic. I have to say, though, I have been involved when I lived in New York City myself in direct actions of various types, and the police were relatively restrained. There was no sort of physical manhandling. I didn't see any of that. They were just kind of dealing with it as it came. I think they were a little bit surprised when the event actually took place, like right at that moment, but they quickly got the whole thing cordoned off. There were two people who, and I'm not sure what charges they will face, but they climbed up on the telephone poles, the light poles, and stretched a cable across the roadway and dropped a banner. I had forwarded a photograph of that, which I'm sure is probably going to be available online on our SoundCloud page pretty soon.
Did people talk about what are their next steps, follow up to this action?
I asked several people about that, and I think they're just trying to encourage people in different cities to take their own actions in keeping with the goals of the whole group. But I think a lot of them are echoing things that have been seen in other places, like, for example, in Seneca Falls, when there was the threat of abandoned salt caverns being turned into a storage area for natural gas. You had many, many, many members of the community and outside the community coming in and day after day after day obstructing the entrance to that. I think that's what this group is essentially trying to achieve here and elsewhere.
Okay,
Dave, New York do that, I don't know.
So Dave, we're out of time. We want to thank you for that on-the-scenes report. I understand you'll have some additional tape interviews next week. I'm actually going to be down there in New York City on Thursday, so I'll be filing some reports from the Williams Project, Williams Pipeline demonstration on Thursday. That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Britta Moberg. Our engineer tonight is Jonah Moberg. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering, shoot us an email, info@mediasanctuary.org. You can stop by one of our weekly meetings, Monday night, 7:07, right here at the Sanctuary. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.